I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, the meaning and value of building community, how togetherness and a reliance on others fulfills a fundamental human need.
Life is about the people you meet and the things you create with them. Our sense of connection and community and meaning is about the relationships we build and the things that come out of those relationships, the creativity, the courage, the beauty. That, for me, is what life's all about.
And are today's independent lifestyles, in the long run, a disadvantage?
We're all only temporarily able-bodied, and so we're gonna need each other, and let alone if you start thinking about the impacts of climate change or any other terrifying future vision, right? We're gonna have to rely on each other more and more and unlearn some of this kind of false independence that we assume we'll continue to live with.
Getting together, how to build community and treasure our connections with each other. That's all coming up on Life Examined. Tribes and clans, villages and congregations, all groups that throughout history have provided a common bond. Our forefathers didn't need to seek out community. Most of them were born into groups. Fast forward to today, transient lifestyles, smaller families, and increased secularism has led to the slow dissolution of those very structures that for centuries supported and nurtured us. And while it's true that we've filled that void with gyms and support groups, classes, clubs, and organizations, it's not that simple. And the freedoms and independence we seem to crave bumps right up against the need to connect, to talk, and rely on each other. Turns out being together these days is very much on our own terms, when and how and if we like it. Casper Ter Kuile is the author of The Power of Ritual and co-founder of Nearness, a digital community of people exploring life's big questions through deep conversations, and he joins me now to share his insight and inspiration on the future of community, ritual, and spirituality. Casper Ter Kuile, welcome back to Life Examined. Great to have you.
Thanks, Jonathan. Great to be with you.
I feel like we use the word community all the time, meaning everything and nothing. It's a thing that we're missing, but we're trying to get it, and we know it's important. So if we just step back for a second and ask ourselves, like, what actually is community? Like, how do we define community? How would you define it? What words would you put to that one word?
I think for me, community is a set of relationships in which I am known and I know the other people. And so I think you're right. You know, that community word gets thrown around in all sorts of ways. My colleagues at Sacred Design Lab talk about community washing, right? This idea that everyone's selling community, but it's not really real.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And so, yeah, I think one of the ways you can kind of test for community is if you don't show up, do people notice that you're not there? And do they care enough to reach out to you to check in on you? And so that's my kind of litmus test for when you really feel like you're in community.
Where did community used to come from? My sense is this answer might take us to old traditions. I mean, religion certainly served that purpose for hundreds or thousands of years, didn't it?
No doubt. And, you know, we talk a lot about building community, but certainly in more traditional structures of life in ye olden days, you know, you were just born into community. It just existed. You didn't have to set about trying to create it because you were born into structures of belonging. That often meant the family primarily, but certainly also geographical boundaries, right? You belong to a village or to a tribe or to a city. And then there were those additional structures, religious structures, civic structures, other community organizations that you might have belonged to. And I think we might look to religion, especially because the kind of congregation as a unit of community is still one that we recognize, even if maybe some of those other structures of a large extended family or a living in a town, as you have done for generations, that's kind of just no longer part of our experience. But certainly religious communities of all stripes have been vital, in part because I think they fulfill a function of community that we might not immediately think of, which is helping people feel part of a larger story. So there's a story of peoplehood, right? You might read stories in those sacred texts, or there might be rituals or traditions in which the community story as a whole is narrated time and again. You know, think of the Jewish Passover celebration, or think about you know, particular festivals in a Christian context too, where you know, maybe saints' days or even the particular founding of a congregation might be celebrated in a particular way, and kind of elders of the congregation are celebrated. But those structures are, for more and more people, less and less resonant. You know, for the first time in American history, at least recorded history, more than half the country is now not part of a religious congregation. So these structures that held us in community are increasingly disappearing.
Interesting. And you really highlighted the importance of placing yourself within a larger story of a people or a group. And it seems to be a theme we come back to on this show a lot, which is the power of the stories we tell about ourselves, but in this case, maybe about the group or the tribe. Why do you think it's important to place ourselves within that larger story, that historical story, the story that ties us to something bigger than ourselves?
It's vital. I don't know if anyone's like me, but I'm pretty self-obsessed. it's very easy to end up just thinking about myself. And I think what these stories do is they pull us out of our immediate self-interest. They pull us out of our limited frame of reference of just thinking about our to-do list and our responsibilities and what we want, and helps us remember that we're part of something bigger and that there are different priorities for us and our collective when we look at that bigger story. In an individualistic frame, you might spend most of your time thinking about how do I get ahead, or, you know, how do I get that the thing that I want? And when you're looking at that bigger story, you're thinking about, you know, how do we pass on the gifts that we've been given? How do we tend for the whole? What do we need to do today to ensure that the next generation will be safe and well? And so those stories take our kind of line of sight away from our bank balance and then to the community's well-being. And that's why they're so important, because without those stories, we kind of lose the sense that there is a collective whole. And I think that's one of the challenges for many of us today, is that we really experience our days as individuals. The nuclear family is perhaps one of the few remaining structures where we really identify ourselves as part of something bigger. But, you know, as is well documented at this point, it's nearly impossible to raise kids with two parents working, let alone one parent. You know, that structure of community is too small to serve our well-being. We need those larger structures to be healthy and well.
I feel with you, I'm also in safe hands to go straight to like the larger mystical level here too. And as we're talking, I keep thinking about the mystical or psychedelic experience, or how we even are talking about awe these days, is one in which we put ourselves in connection to something that is almost unknowably big around us. And it's interesting, when we're talking about this, I almost feel that echoing in the community as well. Like, we're always trying to situate ourselves within something that feels bigger or more important than us, whether that's a spiritual experience or it's a community experience. But have you thought about that? I mean, it seems to all be tied together in a way that I think makes some sense to me.
I love what you're saying there, Jonathan. And absolutely, I think about it in kind of three concentric circles. And maybe to illustrate it, I'll talk about a wedding ceremony. When I'm, you know, officiating a wedding, as I sometimes do for friends, I really encourage them to think about three levels of relationship. That there's the commitment that they are making to one another as a couple. There's a commitment from their community, the people who've gathered to celebrate them and love them, and who, you know, will make a commitment to support that union as long as they both shall live. So those are the first two. But then that final third outer layer of being held is that mysterious something, that whether you want to use higher power or spirit or God or whatever it is that we feel part of in our moments of awe or in our moments of desperation, right? We feel that sense sometimes of something holding us. And so if you're creating a ritual like a wedding celebration, trying to find words or ritual that helps us honor those three levels of community, the couple itself, the community of well-wishers and the couple, and then the couple, the community, and this sense of something larger than us that maybe is beyond any words. I think that's a vital part of a feeling in community, because there's going to be conflict in the couple, that's for sure. There's going to be probably conflict in the community. And so to have that deeper something, that well to draw from, that sense of accompaniment and mystery that is uncontrollable, but therefore also such a renewable resource for hope and kindness and courage and love. I found that's a really helpful ingredient when communities form, to have something kind of eternal to draw from in that way.
Mm. It's just so interesting that those three layers you're talking about are all layers of relationship. I just want to kind of acknowledge that, because you and I both, I think, would also say that we live in such an egocentric time. Like I wake up and I think, oh, how am I going to make myself happy today? Right?
Totally.
Like it's just this, it's just me and how I feel about myself. But you're really talking about these kind of extensive layers of how we interrelate to these different aspects of partnership, community, or spirituality, right? I mean, these are that's how we kind of break out of ourselves, I suppose, right?
Well, and it's very inconvenient. You know, I think something that we have to say is, you know, sometimes we'll talk about community. It's like, ah, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if we all ate our meals together? And, you know, it's easy to kind of end up in these utopian visions. And that's good, right? We want to be inspired. We want to find ways to draw closer to one another. But the reality is, when you are closer to one another, is that those people are annoying.
Yes.
or at least they, you know, want the white pasta sauce and you want the red one, and you just constantly have to navigate each other's desires and ways of being and you know, the volume of their voices. It's just all sorts of ways in which we get on each other's nerves. And so one of the key things I think we have to consider when we're talking about community is, what are the structures that are going to hold us in relationship beyond what we would choose for our comfort? Because if we are constantly looking at relationships of, how is this going to serve me, or how do I get what I want, or how do I have a good time, if that's the only ingredient, we're not going to hang around each other for long, right? Mm. Because the moment you start picking your nose, or I'm scratching my feet, or whatever it is, we need ways in which we're going to be held together long enough to withstand that discomfort. Mm. And that's why I think looking at the structures is so important. So we talked about congregations, we talked about families, but what are the other structures that are going to hold us in relationship long enough to withstand that discomfort and stay long enough that we really fall in love with each other?
No, you bring up such an important point, which is, yeah, there is this kind of utopian idea of like, oh, I can just slide warmly into community or support others. I just kind of was reminded of, I used to do mentoring, like the Big Brothers Club, and I had to drive like 45 minutes across town, and it was always felt like such a, like the day I'd have to do it, I felt like this is such a burden, right?
Yes.
To go help out this like really wonderful young kid, you know, who I really did like love spending time with. But it was like Sundays, I'm like, oh, I've got to go do this again. But without fail, and this was a very common refrain among my other friends that would do something similar, we never wanted to start it, but by the time we did it and drove home, we felt so much better about ourselves. And we were like, why was I complaining about that? You know? And like, so I think it's important to acknowledge that resistance, right? I mean, I think it's something that we probably all similarly share, no?
Well, I hope I'm not alone in it. So I'm glad at
that's
least
right.
it's
or
the
you
two
and
of
I
us.
Are just yeah, that's right.
But I love that illustration, because you know, it is that sense of meaning that you found in that relationship of being of service to this young person, of, you know, helping them navigate questions, or even just being with them. There was something that was intrinsically rewarding for you. You know, you weren't doing it for your CV, or, you know, maybe some other reasons. That, not to say those are bad reasons, but this was a meaning-oriented reason for doing it. Like, you felt useful to this young person. And I think that's often what we're chasing, you know, in the lives we live. We're looking for ways to matter, for ways to find meaning, to make our lives feel like they're worth something. And most of the ways in which, you know, maybe the menu of options that are given to us are about buying things or buying experiences. And that can be beautiful and a lot of fun. But I think, you know, I have a little sign in my kitchen that says, life is about the people you meet and the things you create with them. And I think you were just illustrating that so beautifully, that, you know, our sense of connection and community and meaning is about the relationships we build and the things that come out of those relationships, right? The creativity, the courage, the beauty. That for me is what life's all about. And we need those structures that say, hey, it's Sunday, it's time for you to drive 45 yes. minutes and make, you know, keep the commitment that you've made. Yeah. Because if you didn't, you know, there'd be someone who was going to be there and be disappointed. And I think that's why these structures are so valuable, is that they give us a little bit of a script to follow when our own motivation perhaps is a little lacking.
Mm, and I want to get to those structures in just one second, but just finally, I just want to state, I think, what loners we really have become. It was already on this trajectory, totally. Right? But like, I think of the people, including myself, right, that have moved to a different town in the pandemic. I work alone throughout the days. Yeah. I know so many people that have kind of had to start from scratch rebuilding, because we get you know, allured into new places we want to be and experience. And then I think a lot of people realize when they get somewhere new, they're like, oh my God, I actually don't know anyone. You know, like the luster of just the physical environment yes. can wear off when the people aren't there to support you. That being so, remote work, the lack of religious structures, the idea that, you know, geographically families are just so spread out these days, right? So just to kind of finish that side, you would agree, I take it, that like, we are at a kind of fascinating moment of loneliness, no?
Absolutely. And the data backs this up. You know, Julianne Holt-Lundstad at Brigham Young University has led a meta-analysis of hundreds of different studies and has found that there are two indicators here that are worth paying attention to. The first is social isolation. And that is the way in which we structurally spend more time by ourselves. And you mentioned a couple of them. We're working from home more. More of us are unpartnered or marry at a later age. All the ways in which we just literally spend more time by ourselves. But then the second indicator is our experience of loneliness is also increasing. Now, loneliness is the emotional experience we have of our connections, even when we're with other people. Mm. So if you've ever been to a party and there's plenty of people around, but you're kind of sitting there by yourself wondering, like, what am I doing here? That's a moment of loneliness. So social isolation is the time we spend by ourselves. Loneliness is the quality of our experience of connection. And both of those are going up. And so you're absolutely right. That, you know, this is the Surgeon General's talked about a pandemic of loneliness, right? Mm-hmm. This very intense experience that, something is not quite right. And you mentioned moving to a new town. You know, I did the same thing. My husband and I moved to Brooklyn, New York a few months before the pandemic, not knowing that that was coming. Mm. And, you know, we spent a good 2 years really being pretty isolated. And it took a few weeks before Christmas where I said, I really don't want to spend Christmas alone, right? We have to find someone to spend it with. And we had met this other couple, honestly, two or three times, but we liked them. They were Jewish, so we knew they'd be free. So we said, hey, would you, you know, we texted that kind of first date style text. Would you be willing to pod with us over Christmas? So, you know, we all isolated for a good 10 days and then got together. And what was so beautiful out of that was a weekly dinner and card game night, which lasted for a good 5 months, which if you live in New York City, you do not see the same people every week for 5 months. It's extremely rare, at least in my experience. And what came out of that was this beautiful friendship between the four of us that has really just flourished in a post-pandemic life too. And so I think you're so right that you have to kind of create those structures of community to support yourself, because it doesn't just happen. Because in so much of the modern world, you know, the ways in which you might have made conversation with people are increasingly disappearing as we design all of our systems, especially through technology, for efficiency. You know, you being able to order your food and it being delivered, using a self-checkout machine at the grocery store, all sorts of ways in which life becomes more streamlined, more efficient. What is efficiency but taking away relationship, right? Mm. The chance for a conversation at the checkout counter, having to go outside and running into your neighbor and saying hello. All of those things are kind of being eliminated from our everyday. And so, yeah, we're spending more and more of our time by ourselves. And it's not good for us.
And I think it's important to say that we live under this idea of quote unquote connectivity, right? In a sense that we're always kind of vaguely talking to each other via text or social media or whatever it is.
We're lurking, aren't we? It's not really connection. It's mostly observing. And if you're anything like me, a little bit envying, right?
So sure, of course.
We're consuming content on a YouTube or a TikTok, or we're kind of just like lurking and seeing these other people that we might have met 3 years ago at a conference posting about whatever's happening in their life on LinkedIn. And so it's like the fast food version of connection. It's like you get this hit, but it's actually not very fulfilling.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, even I've been creating and sharing more media online, and it's like I see the people there looking at it, but I'm like craving somebody to write something, like a real response. I'm like, please, like just share a story back at me about something, knowing that that's not gonna, you know, stand in for a face-to-face interaction. But the point being that there's the illusion of connectivity, but not actually the reality, right?
Yeah. Well, and also the absence of it has real impact, not just on our mental health, which would make sense, but on our physical health too. Mm. Again, what came out of the study that Julianne Holt-Lundstad led was that, you know, our need for community and relationship is so significant that when we don't have that, when we don't have that support and connection, it's as impactful on our mortality as being clinically obese or smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And so it's a very, very physical need, that experience of connection. So no wonder we're left longing for it when we don't have it.
Yeah, absolutely. And you've used the word that we need to create structures to situate community. We need reasons to be accountable. And I know this has just been a big part of what you've been thinking about and designing. So welcome us a little bit to the ideas that you have been kind of working with in terms of trying to recreate some of the things that it seems like we really are missing.
Well, you're right. I've become a little bit obsessed with this. and it's because I really, really believe that if it's just left to our own choices, we're going to fall short. And so we need help. And that help comes from the structures that will hold us in relationship. And so, you know, we've talked about a congregation as one example. I think often having hundreds of people in the same place can still leave us feeling a little bit lost and lonely, especially if we're there for the first time. Yeah. And so I've been really interested in units of belonging at a smaller level, and particularly the idea of a small group. So somewhere between, you can find small groups of all shapes and sizes from 4 people up to 12 and maybe even a little larger. And you see this in a lot of recovery communities. Of course, religious communities too might have covenant groups or something like that. But what I've been thinking about is how can we help people into that kind of committed relationship for a certain amount of time to live life and accompany one another. And so with this project called Nearness, what we've been building are small groups of accompaniment over an 8 to 10 week journey. So you sign up, you get matched with 5 or 6 other people, you meet every week for 90 minutes on Zoom and go through a very beautifully structured set of reflection questions and a kind of mindfulness practices together that really build the experience of deep connection. And having that commitment of saying, hey, I'm going to show up every week at the same time with the same people for these rich conversations means that over time, people really quickly go deep together. And just like you were saying, I want to hear what someone else has to say in response to what I'm experiencing. You get that sense of like, oh, we're in this together, even though we're very different. We're living in different places. We believe different things. We're different ages. There's an experience of living life together in a way that's really meaningful.
I feel that the importance of the small group is actually quite vital here, but I'm going to let you talk about that because like I come at this often as a therapist where I think of group therapy, right? And you don't want like 40 people in a room. That's not very helpful. It's more
it's kind of overwhelming.
Yeah. It's overwhelming. Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there needs to be some aspect of intimacy, right? Of safety and of like your voice actually does matter. Why do you think the smaller number for you is so important?
Well, I think you're exactly right. You know, I mentioned that idea of knowing people and being known. And if you're in a group of 6 people and you didn't make it this week, right, people are going to notice. They're going to say, where's Casper? And someone's going to text you or just check in, be like, hey, we missed you. What's going on? Is everything okay? And so that feeling of being missed, of being known, of belonging, of others needing you to be there for the group to feel whole and complete, That is a powerful feeling. In some of the earlier research that I worked on, we looked a lot at fitness communities and, you know, groups of people working out together.
Yeah.
And the culture of accountability in those groups was extremely strong. And it meant that, you know, that sense of being held accountable was not an experience of being shamed or like, you know, that you're bad in some way. It was an expression of care. And so if you weren't there and someone reached out to you, it meant that they wanted you to be there, right? They cared about you. And that feels good. Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why that small group size works well is that people notice and you know, there's enough relationality to have folks check in on you. The other thing that I'll say is exactly like your kind of group therapy example is, you know, you want to go deep with this group. And so if everyone is going to have a chance to share at that depth, it takes a little time. And if you have six people each sharing at that level, you know, you have about an hour and a half to really go there together. But if it's a group of 20 people, you're going to need a weekend. So, you know, just simply the very practical elements of kind of fitting it into your calendar, a smaller group is also a really great, kind of a great fit.
I think you mentioned something that I have thought about as somebody, I'm a big cyclist and endurance athlete, and I occasionally go to things like, you know, group bike rides or a master swim class. And like when I moved somewhere new, I thought, oh, that's my way to tap in. And I'm not trying to kind of push back and say, no, I think you're wrong. But I find that it seemed to me like the easiest way to try and manufacture community or to just be around people, right? Like it's like, and that's what a lot of people think, like go to the group and of your interest. And yet, I feel like maybe it got me 50% of the way there. I'm not really sure I had people calling on me to check in on me. And a lot of times we were just kind of putting our heads down and doing workouts. So do you know what I'm saying? It's like getting half the meal, but not the other half. Like you're still kind of hungry for something else, which makes me think that it's also the quality of the interactions. And my sense is it's the questions that are being asked, like in the way that you designed these groups, that I actually think is quite important here.
Absolutely. And that would be, you know, that just the kind of button on the fitness community example. We were looking especially at CrossFit groups that had a particular trainer who had that kind of orientation, and they were asking questions and they were building a culture where, you know, having those kind of deeper conversations, especially after the workout, not during, that was kind of normal, right? So that people would host their going away party at the gym, or they would do a talent night, you know, so there were other modalities of connection beyond the workout. You're exactly right. And those questions really are key. And that's very much in the design of Nearness too, is, you know, each journey will have a particular theme, like connecting with the natural world, or building support in my local community, or hope. All sorts of different kind of hopefully inspiring and capacious themes that expand our hearts and our minds. And then each week there'll be a particular set of reflection questions that we ask people to engage with. So, you know, you might spend some time thinking about, we're in the midst of this journey about connecting with nature. So you might think about experiences where we try and control the natural world, where we try and, you know, make it fit what we want it to be. And then experiences where we felt the freeness of wilderness kind of in our own experience. And, you know, you spend some time thinking about that, and maybe there's a couple of stories that or themes that you start to think about. And then when you hear three or four or five other people sharing too, suddenly you're really getting somewhere juicy together. Mm-hmm. And you're building on each other's ideas, and each story illustrates a new complexity, or, you know, maybe counters what someone else has shared in an interesting way. And suddenly you're in this rich conversation that you would never get to if you were just sitting next to someone in the bus and, you know, saying hello.
And yeah, so yeah,
I think it's that experience of like, hey, we're all here. We all want to connect with each other. We know we have this time and this structure set aside. Let's go there.
Yes.
And so that's a really crucial experience. And I think one of the important ingredients for helping us do that is what we call our nearness agreements, or you might hear other people talk about norms, or, you know, kind of the rules of how we encounter one another. And it's really important because in our everyday interactions, the culture of conversation doesn't really work if you want to connect with each other in a deeper way. You need to interrupt some of the patterns. So for example, one of the rules we use is no advice giving. And it sounds counterintuitive because if you're going through something that's difficult, and I've been through it too, I might have a lot to share. But if I start telling you, hey, you should check out this book, or have you tried internal family systems, mm-hmm. or whatever it is, it kind of shuts you down in your not knowing. And we return to this place of performing or pretending that we've got it all together. And so having these small groups as spaces where you can kind of share without necessarily knowing if you've got it right, or mm-hmm. if it's going to work out, and know that people are going to listen to you in a loving, gentle, kind of tender way, is such a powerful thing. We talk about the gift that we give each other is really our sustained loving presence. It's not mm-hmm. answers or solutions that we're giving, but it's that creation of relationship.
I really appreciate that, because I think one of the pitfalls of being a listener, in this case, not a very helpful listener, and we've talked about this on the program, is like there is this part of us that just wants to respond with advice, and that's generally not what people want. And so I find that very important, the way you put it. And I guess part of me, and I think you're answering this already, is how do you not feel like the stuff is forced? Right, like, oh my God, I'm just among 10 strangers.
It is kind of forced, you know. And we literally tell people it's gonna feel a little awkward the first time.
Yeah, okay.
It just is, and that's okay. You know, I think just like we talked about with that experience of community, that sometimes it's, you know, frustrating. I think it's just really honest. We just have to be honest about what it's gonna be like, but. And this is the promise that we do make. By the end of your second session, you're going to feel like you know these people better than some of the people in your everyday life. Mm. And that's the reward, right? Like, just like you're coming back from volunteering on a Sunday, you know, it's going to be a little annoying at first, but it's going to be worth it. And once people have that experience, they're like, okay, now I get it. You know, and that makes it worth it.
My guest this hour is Casper Turkile, and we're discussing how to create community. We'll be back with part two of our conversation after this short break. You're listening to Life Examined right here on KCRW. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. My guest this hour is Casper Turkile. He's the co-founder of Nearness, and we're discussing the ways in which we can build community in authentic ways. Let's jump back in. It kind of reminds me of this reflection I had in my own life. I don't have kids right now, but I've been spending time with families, a couple of families that do have kids, like weekend trips, and I've gotten to know these young kids really well. And what I've noticed is that literally all I have to do is just keep showing up and they start loving me, right?
Isn't like, that amazing?
I was just there the other weekend and I wasn't even quite engaging them. They were just like crawling over me, right? And like you know, painting my face and, you know, and I was thinking like, how did this happen, right? Like I'm not, as I said, like consciously trying to connect. And I literally thought, and their parents said, like time is what happened. You're always here and they just start feeling comfortable around you. And I wonder if that's an ingredient here of the connection, which is like continuously showing up with people is going to do something one way or another, you know?
Absolutely. And that there's fascinating studies that say, you know, you need 30 hours of conversation and connection for a real friendship to develop. And so certainly time. And I would add, you know, it's your physical being there, but it's also your quality of presence, right? And that so quickly illustrates, is this someone who's trustworthy, someone who's playful, someone who's gonna pay attention if I ask for it, someone who's not going to demand things all the time of me. And so those are some of the skills, you know, it's the structure that holds us together and then our individual kind of social emotional skills of how we show up. And you're absolutely right. You just kind of have to commit to that and trust that it will lead to those relationships. I think one of the really tricky things for us all to navigate in the world that we live in is how we manage those kind of relationships when we have to move frequently, or we're traveling for right. work, or, you know, someone's, you know, you finally invest in your neighborhood and then half the people move away. You know, the rent in my building just went up by 30%, and like everyone that I got to know, and soon we will too, will be leaving. And right. so there are these forces that kind of push us out of community. And so if we feel like we're struggling with this, it's not just that we're individually struggling with the skills. It's also the economy we live in, right? Like the structures that kind of push our lives around, that make it very, very difficult for this to work. I'll add one little note that has been absolutely haunting me. Mm. And Jonathan, you can use this or ignore it, but I want to share it with you.
Yeah, please.
A friend of mine recently said, you know, capitalism wants us to be alone. Because if we each have an individual mortgage and an individual stove and, you know, a laundry unit, right, that's going right. to increase the GDP. And so I do think it's important to realize, like, there are real structural forces that are pushing us into isolation.
Mm. No, it's fascinating. Like, I live in a neighborhood of little, you know, single family homes, and I probably of, you know, there are 100 homes near me. I kind of know my neighbors on either side. And the biggest breakthrough I feel like I've had with one of my neighbors is we have decided to share a lawnmower, right?
Yes. Like, I love it. The revolution begins.
Talking over the fence. We're like, why do we need two lawnmowers? Like, totally. We don't even have very big backyards, you know?
100%.
And like, it's funny how that one little thing has actually really like connect. We like kind of joke about it now. We're like, how's the lawnmower doing, you know? And
But this is huge, because it's one of the ways in which relationships are sustained, which is when we need each other. And I think one of the things that we were pointing to before around that kind of idea of frictionless societies, right? If I can order everything, if I have my own lawnmower, if everything is possible, as long as I have the money, then I actually don't need other people. And so you're doing a beautiful thing and saying, hey, we're going to rely on each other in this very practical way. And that unit of interaction is going to sustain the relationship. I love that example.
Well, and there are also different, like, interesting design stories around this. Like, right, there used to be more front porches that people would hang out on and just see each other on the street. When I lived in the South in Louisville, Kentucky, all the old houses had porches, right? Yeah. And then I live in a house in the 50s, and it's like, no, everything is tucked away in the back where you can't see anyone at this point, right? I mean, it's like we've designed these ways of thinking we need to be individualists.
Absolutely. And the same is true with, you know, walkable versus drivable cities, the investment right. in public transit. That's getting at exactly what I was pointing to with some of those kind of larger systemic drivers towards isolation.
Right. What are ways that you would suggest kind of starting to create these groups? I mean, obviously, people can join the program that you have done, but like, what are other principles that we can draw from that for, you know, people that do feel isolated, that have moved somewhere new? Where does one begin with this stuff?
Well, it's not easy. So first, if you're feeling that, I feel you, it's tough. And you've got to be brave. And so when you feel brave, take one step and introduce yourself to your neighbor. It's a weird moment. And if you've moved somewhere recently, it's the perfect time to do it. I did it in my building. Mm. And people are kind of like, they're like, why are you saying hello?
Yeah.
But just swapping numbers. And I use the excuse that my husband plays piano. So I was like, if it's ever too loud, please let me know.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
You know, find nice. Some sort of excuse. Maybe there's a tree that's leaning, or maybe whatever. You have a little kid. Find some excuse to make that introduction. And that will help if you're walking around the neighborhood, or if you're walking in and out of your building, you'll be able to you know, just wave and smile and say, hello, how are you doing, Sarah? You know, whatever it is. So that's definitely one. And if you're lucky, and I had this experience because I, you know, said hello to everyone on our floor. There's someone else who's like, oh, I'm so glad you introduced yourself. I want to get to know our neighbors better. We ended up hosting a little meet your neighbors event. And so we just got some cookies and some drinks and, you know, put a little table up on the roof, and we put posters up around the elevator and around the building and said, hey, come meet your neighbors, say hello. And like a third of the building showed up on a Sunday afternoon. And it's not that any great deep friendships came out of that, but the culture of the building completely changed, because it became normal to greet each other, to have a chat in the laundry room. Now, these are, of course, examples from a, dense urban environment like Brooklyn, but you never know who you'll meet and what wonderful things will come out of it. So that's definitely one. But the second one, if you have a friend or one other person that you like or that you want to get to know better, finding some committed way to keep gathering. So maybe you get together for pancakes every Wednesday, or maybe you go see a movie every month, or find some structured commitment, some container for that connection that means that you always know when the next time is that you're going to see each other. For me, that's been really instrumental in building friendships. So like that couple that we got together with, every week for dinner and card games, we just knew that Saturday night was time for that group of friends. And over time, we had in jokes and we started referring to ourselves as the potatoes. And then another friend of theirs moved to town and the potato patch grew. And, now there's a whole potato family. And so, those little kind of cultures of belonging will start to grow with that committed recurrence of connecting with each other.
Do you find that there's value in, not just creating what can feel like, easy relationships with people that share similar interests or political beliefs, but broadening it out? I mean, this was another reflection I had living in the South. I had friends that were like way older and younger than me. Mm-hmm. There just seemed to be a mingling of ages, not necessarily backgrounds, to be honest, but like it was common. You would run into people of, that would be 30 years older or 10 years younger. Like, do you think is there power and importance of trying to not just, hang out with people that kind of look like us and sound like us and think the same things?
It's certainly one of life's great gifts, that there is no doubt about it. And I think it's also increasingly difficult to create those kind of relationships ourselves. One of the gifts of an established community, and maybe we can look at the congregation again as an example, is that you would have all those different life stages in that same community.
Right.
Maladome Patrice Omeh, a wonderful West African teacher and writer, talks about the purpose of the individual is to share their gifts, and the purpose of the community is to receive them. And so if you are, in your 30s, maybe you're a parent, maybe not, but, you're in the kind of stage of life where it's busy and doing all sorts of things. And maybe in your late 70s or early 80s, really your gift is a quality of presence and a listening ear and a gentle, abiding sweetness that you can offer. If you don't have relationships with younger people near you, that kind of goes unused and people start to feel like they're not needed, like they're useless. And we know that's what people experience, when they're not connected to a wider network of relationships across different ages. And as young people, maybe you want to rebel against your parents, but actually it's kind of fascinating to spend time with someone much older who's interested in your life. And so absolutely those relationships are vital. But it's, again, we need those structures of community to bring us together in that way. The more difference you introduce, and certainly when you think about cross-class and cross-race relationships, there's more complexity to navigate, and there is certainly also more opportunity for discomfort and awkwardness and maybe even offense and pain. And so I'm so inspired by organizations that look at that and say, we're going to do it really intentionally and head on. And one organization that I'm so inspired by is Thread, which is an organization in Baltimore that is so intentional about weaving together mostly whiter, mostly wealthier, mostly newer people to Baltimore who want to, volunteer or be connected to the community because they're kind of poor in relationships, and people who are rich in relationships but maybe poorer in terms of money and opportunities, mostly folks of color, mostly poorer. And they match these into kind of family units. And the ostensible or the intended purpose on the kind of surface level is to put young kids who are at risk of dropping out of high school to graduate and make it into college. But what happens over time is that these small groups, and it's usually a couple of volunteers, 3-4 volunteers and one young person, that they become a unit of belonging, and it's a mutual impact. And they don't just say that, they measure the impact not only on the outcomes of the students graduating, but they measure the impacts of these volunteers about how many connections they have in the city, how much meaning they find in their life. And it's a system that absolutely lifts up everybody and sustains those friendships way into later years. So there are ways to do it.
And it's just fascinating, actually, to think about the ways in which being affluent essentially can create utter loneliness. I mean, the flexibility of being able to move every year or to work from home or the ingredients of loneliness, where I think traditionally those that had, you know, a tougher lot or were held down for systemic reasons almost had to band together in community as a survival technique. So it doesn't surprise me that those folks would be rich in relationships. Is that true, do you think?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's that same idea of, you know, when you don't need each other, you spend more time by yourself. Mm. And then the moments when you really do need someone, right? Maybe someone gets sick, maybe a loved one dies and you're grieving. You know, we're all only temporarily able-bodied. And so we're going to need each other. And let alone if you start thinking about the impacts of climate change or any other kind of terrifying future vision, right? We're going to have to rely on each other more and more and unlearn some of this kind of false independence that we assume we'll continue to live with.
Do you feel that there are naturally other groups that tend to form community faster? I mean, we can acknowledge that we're two white guys talking here, right? But
yep,
maybe,
yep.
You know, other, I'd imagine maybe different genders or marginalized communities. Is that something that you've noticed?
That's a great question. Certainly when people have a shared experience, it fast-tracks connection. And so if you're, you know, a woman in a male-dominated workplace and you're having lunch with another woman, there is plenty to talk about, right? And you might have some shared interests as well as, such kind of shared interests that you want to achieve together in addition to the shared experiences or shared identities. So one way I might think about this is, what do you want to create, right? Do you want to have a street party, or do you want to have a chance to learn how to make watercolors? Whatever it is, you want to have a pickup basketball game. Finding other people who want to create something similar is a great way to really build a strong relationship. If you have that shared direction of travel, that shared desire to create something, that's a great way to connect with someone quickly.
I also wanted to reflect that you said something which is so important, which is that, you know, people can be annoying, right? Like holding community together can be hard. And I'm very curious on your take on this. Like, we've done programs on estrangement that have felt very, very powerful to me. And there's, I think, a growing trend that people are cutting themselves off from other people or family members because they don't want to be around them. And oftentimes it can be very warranted, you know, and other times we're not sure it's warranted. But I think there is a bit of a notion these days, maybe also when we think about the world of dating or online romance, where there can always be more options, the illusion of option, or that we're always trying to kind of guard oneself as the primary thing. And if those that don't feed it should be discarded, right? I wonder how much you see this and how this plays into our world as well, whether it be, you know, our ability to form community or really our lack of ability to form community as well.
Well, you've hit on exactly the topic that I'm going to write about for my next book. This is great. Yeah, I think we hear so much in the culture about the boundaries we need to keep toxic people away.
Right.
And I'm really interested in what are the boundaries that keep loving people close. And so you're right. It's not to say that that kind of distance or estrangement is wrong. But I certainly think that we sometimes misidentify the purpose of relationships. I was talking with a friend yesterday, you know, he's progressive kind of Democrat, and his mother in her 80s now, I believe, is, you know, thinks Fox News is too liberal. Mm. And he has a lot of friends asking him, like, how are you, you know, still talking with your mom? That's terrible, you know, A, B, and C. And he says, well, you have to understand, I'm in relationship with my mother, not because I want to convince her, but because I want to be in relationship with her. And so, you know, the purpose of that, you know, child-parent relationship is not about agreeing,
right?
But it's about sustaining the care and love they have for one another. And so, of course, there's much more complexity than that. But I illustrate it just as a way of thinking, like, what do we know our relationships to be for? And I think sometimes there's a little bit of a temptation to, design all our relationships for not just our comfort, but our edification, rather than actually being embedded within that kind of web of relationships.
So, I mean, not to generalize your point of view here, but it sounds like you think that maybe being with discomfort or looking beyond just shared interests or political beliefs is actually like a crucial part of a relationship, or at least reason enough to stay with someone, even if those things don't align.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think the key thing is to make sure that that discomfort is distributed as equally as possible, right? I don't want to hang out with a homophobic neighbor every day because like it's good to be in relationship with him. But like, am I going to seek out a big argument about it? No. Right. But so because my neighborly relationship does not demand that kind of intensity. What I want to be able to do is, you know, do I trust him to have a key? Is he going to, you know, all sorts of other things. So that might be too extreme an example, but I think you're exactly right that, you know, life is, as I said, about the people we meet and the things we create with them. And so cutting off entire groups of people just because they challenge some of our ways of thinking or understanding the world, I think means we miss out on some of the rich experiences life has to offer.
Yeah. Well, we'll begin to wrap this up, and I just want to kind of ask if, you know, what else has been on your mind in this process, or what have you seen in these small groups that you have created that's maybe surprised you in certain ways, that's given you hope or maybe given you more questions? How's it kind of all going, this idea of trying to bring people together at this point?
You know, one of the things I've enjoyed so much is that people finish their small group time and say, my husband just told me I listened to him differently. like my colleagues just said how patient I was. And so what I want to say is that these small groups are not just ends in themselves, but they're also practice grounds for how we might show up in every other relationship that we have. Because each time that we're intentionally cultivating that listening presence, or we're being more patient when someone is struggling to articulate what they think or feel or have experienced, That's a way in which we are formed then to go out into the world and be that more patient, present kind of person. So I think we're always being formed in one way or another, and these small groups are an opportunity to really be choiceful in who we want to become.
Well, it's been such a pleasure to be joined by Casper Terkile, co-founder of the Nearness Project and author of The Power of Ritual. Thank you so much, Casper, for joining us. I love these continued conversations, and we hope to have you back again soon.
I was going to say, I'll come over for that beautifully new lawn cared drink at your house at some point. Thanks, Jonathan.
That's it for this week. The producer of Life Examined is Andrea Brody. You can connect with me directly on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan W. Bastian, or connect with other listeners on our Facebook group. Thanks again for joining us on Life Examines. Once again, I'm Jonathan Bastian. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you soon. Take care.